Welcome to Saturday Night at the Movies, the podcast that celebrates classic, cult, and current films and the people that made them, and many other aspects of pop culture. I'm your host, Steve Rubin. Our producer is Ben Shrewsbury, and our signature theme was composed by Greg Lehrhoff. Here it's always Saturday Night, and our mission is to chronicle film and pop cultural history one memory at a time. Tonight, we're joined by Los Angeles television and radio personality and film historian Manny Pacheco, who is also the author of the celebrated books Forgotten Hollywood, Forgotten History, Son of Forgotten Hollywood, Hollywood History, and Road to Forgotten Hollywood, Forgotten History. He also hosts the podcast Manny Pacheco's Forgotten Hollywood on Spotify. Welcome, Manny.
Well, thank you for having me on, Steve. This is going to be a lot of fun. I can tell already.
You never forget anything, do you?
No, I try to bring together Hollywood history with Americana and what I metaphorically call Hollywood and Vine moments. So that's what we plan on doing today.
Well, I brought up the appropriate picture. We'll get to Frank Morgan later. But yeah. Obviously, these are your books, and I'm delighted. I think I hear you on the radio a lot because I tune into KNX. KNX is literally the only real news station on the radio anymore. And you're the traffic reporter.
Yep. You can hear me mostly on the weekends, middays, 11 a.m. till about 5 p.m. But, you know, I fill in now and then each week whenever there's some big things come up, like our rains we had recently. So, yeah, I'm busy with that. That's kind of my day job. And I also teach media history at three local colleges in Southern California, over at Fullerton College, Rio Hondo College in Whittier, and Mount San Antonio College in Walnut, California. So there you go.
You are not a man that stays idle.
No, I keep very, very busy. That's true.
So before we're going to talk a lot about some wonderful character actors, but I did want to mention to the viewers and listeners today that we are mourning the loss of one of the original cast members of Porky's.
Oh, really?
Yes, Porky's. Yeah. Tony Gannios, who played Meat.
Yeah.
Anthony Tupperello, who I have a special connection to Porky's because in the early 1982, I was assigned as the unit publicist on Porky's 2 the next day.
Well, that's a sad loss, but it's nice to hear that you were on the set of Porky's 2. That's pretty cool.
I arrived in Miami, Florida in the summer of 82. And the first Porky's movie had done over $100 million in box office, which was the highest box office ever for a comedy. And I was all set to publicize, being a publicist, that's what we do. Right. And they informed me that the set was closed. So I'm about to spend 3 months in Miami on the set of Porky's, and I can't invite any press. So
wow.
It presented me with quite a quandary. What am I going to do with my time? Well, I got to know the guys really well, and I believe it was Wyatt Knight, the late Wyatt Knight. He's also gone. He hosted a poker game in his trailer every night. So when we were shooting at nights, and I remember walking in there one day on some publicity business, and they're playing with matchsticks. So the next day, I went out to the local drugstore and I bought them a set of chips. And of course, they invited me to play with them. And that's all I did all summer was play poker with the guys at Porky's. In fact, we got to be such poker buddies that when the film stopped shooting, I called up one of the Las Vegas chip manufacturers. And I told them I was attached to one of the most successful comedy franchises in history. And Manny, would you believe they sent me a chest of Porky's chips?
And believe me, I guarantee you that anybody who ever went to Vegas from that poker team or group paid back all that money the chips were worth. They never lose.
Some.
They never lose.
So let's talk about early Manny. You're growing up in, did you grow up in Southern California?
Right. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, went to Van Nuys High School, also graduated at UCLA, a political science major, if you can believe it. But right before I graduated, I ended up working and getting a job at the historic KRLA, 1110 AM KRLA. I was hired by the legendary Art LeBeau, who is in, of course, the Radio Broadcasting Hall of Fame. He actually was my mentor until he died recently. He actually was working until the day he died. He was 97 when he died. And but he is in the Hall of Fame, and he was my mentor, and I can do a whole lot worse than the legendary Art LeBeau in Southern California. And
What was your first job on the show?
actually, I was not on the air. I was the assistant promotions director, but one of the things I did involved being on the air. I gave away what they called walking around money. Wham! Walking around money. $100 for anybody who had a bumper sticker on their car, and then I would approach them. Of course, you can't do this today, but back then in the 1980s, you can walk up to somebody, mention that they have a bumper sticker, have them turn on their radio, and if the radio was on KRLA, they would win $100. And of course, I would record this, and I would record their reactions. I would record my reactions with them. And I guess I impressed the powers that be so much that my next job there was to become the evening request and dedication show host. And so that's what I did for a couple of years.
So let's go back further. Growing up in Van Nuys, what was your movie theater of choice when you were when you first remember going to the movies?
The Sherman Theater was a great place for me to go. And eventually that became like the New Art Theater, where they started showing different movies every day. But this is way back. I would see some great films, and my family, my dad and my mother had no qualms about taking my sister and I to R-rated films. And they didn't mind that. And but of course, it would have the opposite effect on children. We would, of course, cover the blankets over our faces, and we would get embarrassed. But I would get to see really wonderful films as a kid, like The Graduate or Bonnie and Clyde. And well, I remember one particular afternoon just going to a matinee, a midday matinee, with my mother, and we saw a one. The bill was, of course, the A film was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, but then they backed it up with a B film, which was a more modern film, but it just did nothing at the box office, and it's become one of my favorite films, The Hot Rock, with Robert Redford, so it and George Segal. So I remember, and I became a big fan of Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon. Together and separate, I remember going to see The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3.
Oh, it's one of my all-time favorite movies. You could bounce
Absolutely.
quarters off that dialogue. Oh my God.
So these were the films that I grew up with. I loved the comedies. I loved the stars. I grew up loving the idea of following Spencer Tracy. I became aware of him when he was nominated for a Best Actor in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, not knowing that he already had passed away.
Right.
And to this day, Spencer Tracy remains my favorite actor. So,
You're in good company there.
yeah.
A lot of us just treasure every moment on screen. One of my favorite roles of his is in Father of the Bride.
Absolutely.
Oh, and although Steve Martin did a very good job in the remake, there's just something very funny about Spencer Tracy in that original. So when did you start to work on your books now? What motivated you to these wonderful Forgotten Hollywood books?
Well, in 2008, 2009, I was having a conversation with Art LeBeau, and he had mentioned, Manny, you really need to step out of my shadow, which is, I think, kind of funny because he is 5'6" and I'm 6'5". But that said, I mean, he was right. He was, of course, a legend, and he knew that I wanted to do more than just be like the weekend DJ or the evening DJ. And I had mentioned to him that I had a great love of film, and I wanted to write books about the actors. And he says, "Well, look for a niche. Look for something that's different, because if you write about somebody like James Dean or Marilyn Monroe, you're going to be joining hundreds of authors. You got to find something that's a little different." And it wasn't until I watched the HBO special of John Adams with Paul Giamatti, of course, nominated this year for an Oscar. But he was so brilliant and telling the story of a man who lived in the shadows. John Adams was a great, great patriot, but he lived in the shadows of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and Ben Franklin. And I realized that you could tell wonderful stories about people who live in the shadows. And then I thought, wow, how about those great character actors whose name appears below the titles of films? They're not the ones who are at the top of the list, like Clark Gable and Myrna Loy and William Powell and Spencer Tracy and all the rest. And I thought to myself, they made just as many films as the A-listers. And then as I did my research, I discovered they have great stories to tell, either about their private lives or their lives in their careers. And that's where I came up with these forgotten Hollywood stories. And you know, it's funny, I interviewed for a documentary, I interviewed Margaret O'Brien, and she was kind of chastising me, saying, "You know, we're not forgotten." And I tried to remind her, "No, I realize that. I like to tell stories though that have not been told, because those are the stories that are forgotten." And you know, truth be told, if you look at our young folks today, they remember, you know, Marilyn Monroe. I mean, that's not Elizabeth Taylor. That's not, they're not going to become forgotten. But you know, you can look at somebody like Ward Bond, or you can look at Charlie Grapewin, and you go, "Oh, that face is very familiar. What's their names?" And those are the folks that are rapidly becoming forgotten. The faces are familiar, but the names are forgotten. And I wanted to make sure that at least I have that footprint there, so that they get a little bit more, you know, headlines, a few more press clippings, a few more stories to be told. And that was my intention.
I occasionally do commentary tracks on Blu-ray releases, and my friend Steve Mitchell, who's a fellow film historian, we do all the World War II movies that Kino Lorber does. And we were doing a movie called Armored Attack from 1943, Dana Andrews, Ann Baxter, and Walter Brennan's in that movie. So just to do a little research on Walter Brennan, I happened to look up his credits. I think that movie was released in 43. I think in one of those years, 41 or 40, Walter Brennan was in 35 movies in one year. And then the following year, he was in 29 movies. So
Wow.
he was in 64 movies in two years.
You know, and at the age of 38 or 39, he looked 60, and he looked the same throughout his entire career. So he was really typecast. And in my Walter Brennan chapter in my first book, I actually make mention that the folks who lived in the Old West really didn't look like John Wayne or Randolph Scott, or they didn't look like Gary Cooper. They looked like Gabby Hayes and Pat
Or
Buttram
Walter Brennan.
or Walter Brennan, because I mean, come on, they didn't take a bath for a week. They lived on beans and coffee, and you know, they weren't shaving all the time. So I mean, they had to look really scraggly, and of course Walter Brennan fit that mold to a T. So
Oh.
yeah.
When he played opposite John Wayne and Dean Martin and Rio Bravo, playing Stumpy, because he walks with a
Stumpy.
limp. Just classic, classic. Well, we got to get to some of the people you'd like to focus on because I know your book is filled with characters. I am going to pull up a picture here.
56, by the way, 56 and counting. I've got another book coming out soon that'll put me up to about 75 different actors. So
Let's start out with this gentleman who.
yeah, I can, let's do that. Sidney Greenstreet, but I like to tell my story in conjunction with Peter Lorre, actually.
Oh, would you like me to pull up Peter Lorre first?
No, either one. I mean, obviously Sidney Greenstreet began his career at the same time that John Huston was just getting started as director, and of course Humphrey Bogart was becoming an A-lister, and it all came to fruition with The Maltese Falcon, obviously. And it was the only time that Sidney Greenstreet was nominated for an Oscar. But the story that I tell is that wonderful odd couple companionship that Sidney Greenstreet had with Peter Lorre. The two of them together made what, eight, nine films. It started with The Maltese Falcon, and their second film was even bigger. I mean, we're talking Casablanca. In a movie, they don't even appear together because, of course, they kill off the Peter Lorre character pretty early on. But it was Jack Warner who noticed that certain quality, that chemistry that Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet had. So he ordered more movies with them together. And think about this: one is tall and heavy and much older, with a very serious voice, and the other is short with the banjo eyes and the funny voice. Sidney Greenstreet only had an 8-year career. Peter Lorre had a 30-year career, but together they were able to make movies about the duplicitous nature of crime and punishment and war. And at the same time that they were making these great movies together, FDR had ordered, and of course, When I tell this story back in 2012, 2013, 2014, this is a brand new story. But now that Oppenheimer's out, I'm telling a very familiar story. You had all of these scientists and military personnel across the country working on what we now know as the Manhattan Project. And they were bringing their families in tow, as they show in Oppenheimer. You got all these families living together in these little communities on the military bases, of course, trying to defeat Axis aggression. And Saturday night was the only time that they had off. They didn't show this in Oppenheimer, but I can tell you, Saturday night was the one day all of these officials, these scientists, these military personnel had off. So during the day, they would be with their families and have picnics. And at night, it was movie night. And they would watch these first-run movies that were donated patriotically by RKO and by 20th Century Fox and MGM and Warner Brothers. And they would see movies that would include all of the top stars, including Sydney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre. Well, one of these scientists became a big, big fan of the Maltese Falcon. And he was also a big fan of the man who wrote the Maltese Falcon and the Thin Man. And so because of that, because it was the same author, because of that, when they started testing the bombs, as they did in Los Alamos in New Mexico, they decided that they were going to nickname that first bomb the Thin Man. And so that was the nickname of the bomb. And then when we started getting ready to send those bombs off to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that same man, his last name was Serber. I believe it was Robert Serber. That was the scientist's name. He decided that he was going to name the bombs because they looked drastically different. The bomb dropped in Hiroshima was small and slender. The other bomb was rotund. It was a big bomb. And so he decided to name them the Little Boy and the Fat Man, together tying Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet to the end of World War II.
What a great story.
I know. And you know, since I've written my books, I can even add to the story if you'll let me, because I think we have the time today.
Of course we do.
The Nagasaki bomb was having trouble being placed in the plane, and they really had to work out the logistics. So they had to scour the countryside for somebody who made clamps. Well, there was somebody who owned and operated a clamp manufacturing company that came up exactly with those clamps that would hold the Nagasaki bomb. And that owner of that plant happened to have a movie career. He had given up being in the movies because he was constantly overshadowed by his partners. So when his partners moved from Paramount to MGM, Harpo, Zeppo, and Chico, I'm sorry, Harpo, Chico, and Groucho let Zeppo retire. And it was Zeppo Marx who owned that manufacturing company that held those bomb that bomb from Nagasaki together. And again, another tie to Hollywood.
What a great story that is.
And let me add one more addendum, if you let me.
I'm gonna go addendum move on.
As the war ended, we still wanted to test atomic energy. Of course, you know, Oppenheimer became fervently against it after, as you if you watch the movie, you know. But it didn't stop us from still testing, and we continued to test, including in the South Pacific, where a couple of soldiers who were going to test the bomb that was going to be dropped in one of the really remote islands of the South Pacific. The night before, those soldiers went to go see their favorite actress in a movie, Gilda. And so, after in honor of Rita Hayworth, they nicknamed the bomb Gilda. And when Rita Hayworth found out about this, she was livid. She was angry. She said, "How can you say, are you trying to tell me that my career is made up of bombs?" And it took her husband, Orson Welles, to try to calm her down and say, "Look, if you remember, the bomb in Hiroshima was named after the Enola Gay, who was the mother of the actual pilot who dropped the bomb in Hiroshima. Well, they're complimenting you. So calm down, write them an autograph, send them an autograph, write them a letter of thanks, and understand that you are now part of history."
Absolutely.
So, and that's how I tie Sidney Greenstreet, Peter Lorre, with their seven or eight or nine films together, along with Zeppo Marx and Rita Hayworth. to the end of World War II.
You know, when Paul Harvey used to do his radio shows and his interesting stories, your stories remind me a lot of Paul Harvey, because he would find these little nuggets of historical information. And for the listeners and viewers who are watching today, you know, history is such an important part of our lives, and it should be taught more and more to young people, because it shouldn't be a chore to get through history class.
And if you can tell fun stories that tie to history, it makes it more, it comes more alive to the students that I teach. And I know that for others who teach as well, that they try to find those little nuggets and those gems of stories that'll keep the student captivated. And that's what we try to do.
Sure. No, no, no.
Now, what if I told you, now, what if I told you that motion pictures also has a tie to the Kennedy assassination? And it's not Marilyn Monroe. It's not Marilyn Monroe.
Wow. Now, this is interesting, because I'm a real student of the Kennedy assassination. Obviously, the Zapruder film was a major part of that whole story, and the fact
Sure.
that Oswald was captured in a movie theater where they were showing a Van Heflin movie.
Well, that's where we're gonna go with Van
Okay.
Heflin.
Talk about
You talked yourself into the story, and that's the story. And
cry of battle, right?
yes, and that's where we're gonna go, because Van Heflin, who knew that he would be tied to the Kennedy assassination?
Okay, hang on.
And
Let me put up a picture of one of my favorite actors.
well, a consummate actor, a silent, stoic actor in the tradition of Spencer Tracy, wins an Academy Award early on in 1942, and really never had a bad career. Now, he made a lot of bad movies, but it wasn't his fault. The writing could be bad, but he was always good. And as a matter of fact, you'll remember this, Steve. I don't have to tell you. A bad movie in the 1930s or the 1940s, maybe the 1950s, they had a name for those movies. They would call them stinkers. Right? Oh, that's a stinker. Bad sets, bad writing, bad direction. The critics would just go off on these stinkers. And Van Heflin, truth be told, he had a number of stinkers that he made. But to his credit, the critics would say, like in the third paragraph, one bright spot in the movie was the acting of Van Heflin, because he was always so good. And he would actually bring the stinker to life a little bit. He would actually rise, it would rise to the occasion of his acting, because he was that good. I'm with you, Steve. I'm part of that bandwagon that just absolutely loves Van Heflin. He's not talked about enough, as far as I'm concerned. Very underrated actor. But in 1963, the movie studios had come up with this big epic movie that they felt was not going to be a stinker, and they wanted to put Van Heflin in this movie, and they were so convinced that this movie was going to do great, they decided they were going to put this movie across the country, one of these wide releases, everywhere. It's going everywhere. And so they put it in every movie theater, including a movie theater in the suburbs of Dallas, California, Dallas, Texas. Dallas, Texas is where you was going, something very monumental was going to happen in 1963. And so it was there that Lee Harvey Oswald entered a Dallas theater that was showing a Van Heflin movie called Cry of Battle. And the critics, when they got through with that movie, they made sure it was assuredly a stinker. But here's the thing. That movie theater still exists,
Oh, really?
and now only shows Spanish-speaking movies. But you can walk into that movie theater, and you can see the place where Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested. They have a placard right on the seat, making this an official national monument. So they will never be able to tear down this theater, because the seat is considered a monument. And so they left it there. If you sit in that seat, you will be in the back of the seat, you will have that placard that reads, "Here's where Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested." So most people remember, of course, the Zapruder film, and they remember the bank deposit, or the was it the school depository? It was a school depository. They
The
remember
book, school book depository.
the school book depository. That's right.
Right.
And they remember, of course, November 22nd, 1963. They just don't remember the movie that Lee Harvey Oswald was watching. And
I think
there again, yeah, you're tied to, Hollywood and history.
I think when they were titling that movie, they were probably playing off the fact that Van Heflin had been in one of the biggest hits of 1955,
Battle Cry.
Battle Cry.
They tried.
Exactly.
And those are, you know what they call those? I mean, William Wellman had a term for those. Those were cheaters. They try to bank off a successful film by making a film that's similar, that's cheaper in cost, cheaper in direction, cheaper in budget. Everything's cheaper. So yeah, that was a kind of a cheater, and that's why it became a, not as good a film. So.
Well, every Sunday morning, I start walking near the corner of Kenter Canyon and Homewood, and across the street, going up Tiger Tail, the first house is the home, former home of Van Heflin. So
Wow.
I think of Van every time I walk up there. Of course, I've seen so many of his movies. As you probably know, I did the Twilight Zone Encyclopedia,
Right.
and Van was in Patterns. One of
Right.
his early successes in the television sphere, he did that wonderful t live TV broadcast of Patterns, which was written by Rod Serling, won a lot of awards that year. And in fact, I think it was the first time they ran a live television drama, and it was so successful, they ran it again live. It had a repeat performance, which was crazy.
And that's one of, Rod Serling's forgotten treasures. I mean, everybody seems to remember Requiem for a Heavyweight. I mean, they remember The Twilight Zone, obviously. But Patterns, even the movie version of it is a remarkable film. And Ed Begley just tears your heart out in that film. Everett Sloan is great as the villain. And of course, Van Heflin, of course, the glue to the whole thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So let's pull up another classic person.
Arthur, if you could pull up Arthur Lake, that would be great.
Here is Arthur. And I remember, of course, Arthur from all the wonderful Blondie movies. He
Sure.
played Dagwood. I think I first saw Dagwood in the comic strips, of course. And of course, he lent his name to that famous sandwich.
We're going to talk about all of those. Yes. The chapter I call it from the from the sublime to the ridiculous. Here is a man who had a marginal film career, but he had a life that was unbelievable. I mean, you could make a movie on his life. It was so amazing. So at times it was sublime, at times it was ridiculous. The sublime part, of course, is that as he was rising as a comic, kind of in the tell me if I'm wrong about this, deal. I'd like your opinion on this. But he reminded me when talkies emerged, he kind of reminded me as of a vocal version of Harry Langdon. I saw a lot of Harry Langdon in what Arthur Lake did.
That's very fair. I think so. I think so.
Yeah, you watch him in Topper, for example, and he's very, very Harry Langdon-esque. In my estimation, and I might be off on that, but that's how I feel. But he didn't do much more, and he was kind of typecast. But here's the thing: he was very popular in polite society, especially at the Hearst Castle with, of course, William Randolph Hearst and Marion Davies. In fact, Marion Davies and Arthur Lake became fast friends. They were very close buddies, and eventually, Arthur Lake met the how do I put this politely? The love child of. Of Marion Davies and William Randolph Hearst. They referred to her as a niece, but I think most people knew that she was not the niece. And Arthur Lake married this love child and became overnight a millionaire. He never had to work again. He was an heir to the Hearst fortune. And he never did anything to lose that opportunity to become an heir to the fortune. So here is a man who could have made more films, but at this point in his young part of his life, he was rich beyond his belief. And all he had to do was just entertain party if he chose, just like Marion Davies. And he chose to do a lot of that. And I think his career suffered because of that. But I will tell you that William Randolph Hearst, for his part, was very kind. And here's something you're going to love, Steve. When they were looking for a vehicle for, just like they always look for Marion Davies vehicles, when they were looking for a vehicle to have Arthur Lake in a movie, they turned to his newspaper empire, Hearst's empire, and they found in the comic strips Blondie. They never brought out Blondie to, to advance the career of Penny Singleton. They brought out Blondie as a vehicle for Arthur Lake. So the Blondie was actually made because of Dagwood Bumstead. So, I mean,
Although I would say if they called the series of movies Dagwood,
it
it wouldn't
wouldn't
have nearly been said.
have no, it wouldn't have worked. But actually it came to life because they were looking for something for Arthur Lake, and he was quite content at being a Dagwood Bumstead. Now, he had plenty of time off, and though he embraced the character, I mean he had plenty of time off to do charitable things. And one of the things that he got himself involved with was, of course, the Hollywood Canteen, the of course the soldiers' refuge that was created by John Garfield and Betty Davis and others. But he spent lots and lots and lots of time at the Hollywood Canteen, entertaining the troops and spending time with the troops and whoever else would show up. And in one evening, he did meet a young lady, seemed very sad and forlorn, had a chance to chat with her. She gave him his number, or she gave him her number, and then she went away. Well, 2 weeks later, that woman was found murdered in Leimert Park. And to this day, that murder has never been solved. The Black Dahlia murder was the most sensational murder case in history. And instantly, talk about a sublime situation. Arthur Lake became a suspect in the murder of,
Really?
yes,
Wow.
of
Now,
the
it's interesting. In those days, the studios were very careful with their stars, and they actually hired people to make sure their names did not
Sure.
get into the newspapers. That obviously didn't work, and it became cause célèbre.
Well, because so many people in Hollywood became suspects. Elizabeth Short was her name. But I mean, Orson Welles was a suspect. The owner of the LA Times was a suspect. I mean, this became a big, big story across, and it just right across Los Angeles headlines. Of course, Arthur Lake had nothing to do with her murder, and was quickly dismissed as a suspect. But imagine this: here, for one moment, he's the richest, one of the richest actors in Hollywood, and now he's a suspect in a major crime. So, so we've talked about, some of the sublime aspects of Arthur Lake. Now, shall we get to the ridiculous? What was Dagwood Bumstead known for? Well, he was always late for work, and to the poor postman who always suffered the consequences with letters flying everywhere. All of a sudden you'd see that was one of his things. He was always late, running into the postman, and that was it for the postman for the day. He was done and knocked out in the bushes. The other thing, of course, as you alluded to, he is obviously known for these wonderful large sandwiches with all sorts of meats and cheeses and tomato and an olive on the top. And they, of course, became known as the Dagwood sandwich. And the Dagwood sandwich became so popular across restaurants across the country. And people just love these Dagwood sandwiches. And as the
Have you,
films,
by the way, Manny, have you ever tried to eat a Dagwood?
well, they're like this.
You got to have the mouth of a lion.
One bite of an elephant is what I say. So, as the movies gave way to the television show, of course, Penny Singleton was not going to do the television show, but Arthur Lake was like, I got time. Let me be Dagwood on TV. So he went on and became
So
Dagwood.
did they recast? They found a new Blondie?
They found a new Blondie, but Dagwood was Arthur Lake, and that was the key. And he had plenty of time on his hands, so he started appearing at his Rotary meetings as the guest speaker. And whenever he started speaking at the Rotaries, they would serve for lunch the Dagwood sandwich in his honor, which I thought was a really nice thing to do. And so every single time he was at a Rotary throughout Southern, and remember, there's a lot of Rotaries in Southern California, over 90 in Los Angeles alone. He would just appear at these Rotary functions and they would serve the Dagwood. Well, once he retired, the Dagwood sandwich was still in demand by the Rotary Club. And one of the Rotary members, a Rotarian, was a restaurateur and wanted to actually feature the Dagwood or the Rotary Club sandwich at his restaurant. He couldn't call it the Dadwood. That was trademark. But he could call it the Rotary Club Sandwich. But he said, you know, I don't know. I don't think Rotary kind of sparks any kind of creative imagination. So what he did is he shortened the name of the sandwich to the Club Sandwich. The Club Sandwich is a derivative of the Dagwood.
Oh,
And
wow.
the most popular sandwich in America is credited to the insane Arthur Lee.
That's funny. You know, I worked at McDonald's back in the late 60s, and they called it the Big Mac,
Yes.
right, with the club slice in the middle. And I think that they also probably were inspired by the Dagwood. It's funny, people remember the Dagwood more than they remember Arthur Lake, but thanks to you and your books, Forgotten Hollywood, Arthur Lake is alive.
Well, I do have another food footnote.
I'm ready for it. I'm getting hungry listening.
I know. Well, this food footnote is really is silly. As you know, Irving Thalberg was not a healthy man at MGM.
Right.
And so he had to be very particular on what he ate. And along with his wife, Norma Shearer, they would go to the Brown Derby often. And so he once pulled over the owner of the Brown Derby and said, can you do me a favor? Can you like compartmentalize a salad for me? So some days I can eat certain things and I can pick and choose what I want. So the owner of the Brown Derby, his last name being Cobb, said, sure, I'll be happy to compartmentalize a salad for you. Can we call it the Cobb salad? And of course, Irving Thalberg was so honored by that that became the main salad at the Brown Derby, the Cobb salad, another tie to Forgotten Hollywood.
That's a great story. You've got some great ones there, Manny. I love them. I love the minutia. I feel like I've lived in minutia most of my life and loving it. That's a great story. Let's see who's going to pop up next.
Definitely Frank Morgan.
Okay, we got to put up Frank Morgan, of course, forever immortalized as the Wizard of Oz, Professor
Yeah.
Marvel, the gate guard, the soldier guard, the carriage driver.
You know, he worked at also the greatest studio of all. I mean, you know what MGM is known. More stars than there are in the heavens.
Heaven's right, of
And then
course.
and they couldn't argue. I mean they had them all. You know, they had what, Gene Harlow, Norma Shearer, William Powell, Myrna Loy, Spencer Tracy, Clark Gable, Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney. The most popular actor of Hollywood's golden age worked at MGM, making twice as much money for gate tickets than any other actor in the entire 30s and 40s and even into the 50s. You know who that actor might have been? They worked at MGM.
Mickey Rooney.
Second place. Good guess. Very good. The Andy Hardy movies secured his second place
Wait,
status.
the most expensive actor at MGM.
Well, actually, not the most expensive, but the one who brought in the most gate receipts, the
The
one who got the
most
theater
gate
tickets.
receipts
Yeah.
at.
And
Wow, that's.
Mickey Rooney was number two.
Well, Mickey Rooney was number two. Who was number one?
Lassie. But
That's funny.
yeah, well, there you go. But here's the thing. Louis V. Mayer had two favorite actors, and their last names were not Gable. They appeared below the titles of films, and they were part of Hollywood ro royalty, to be honest with you. I mean, one, of course, was Lionel Barrymore. You say the name Barrymore, and that's royalty. But the other was named Morgan, and Morgan was Hollywood royalty. Frank Morgan, of course, worked at MGM. His brother, Ralph Morgan, founded the Screen Actors Guild, co-founded it. And of course, worked in many Westerns. He was the heavy, you know, in a lot of Westerns. So, I mean, Morgan was a name to be reckoned with. And the problem is that Frank Morgan neither liked Lionel Barrymore, and he didn't even like his brother, Ralph Morgan. And here's why. Frank Morgan was a very insecure actor, very scared all the time, always upset that Lionel Barrymore was getting the parts that he wanted. And Lionel Barrymore wasn't turning down roles. So, unfortunately, he seemed to be second banana to Lionel. And all you need to know is that in 1935, Louis B. Mayer gave the first of only two lifetime contracts to an actor. That means that you work until the day you die at MGM. The first one went to Lionel Barrymore, and then a year later, he gave a second lifetime contract, and he gave it to Frank Morgan.
Oh, wow.
And Frank Morgan was not happy because he was again second. I mean, all you need to know is that when Lionel Barrymore walked into the office of Louis B. Mayer, he would actually call him by his first name. How you doing, Louis B.? You know, Frank Morgan, he would stutter and stammer, and he would walk in unsure of himself, and he would say, "Well, you wanted to see me, Mr. Mayer?" I mean, that's how he was, very, very deferential and very insecure. And you know, Louis B. Mayer, to his credit, wanted to protect his actor, so he scoured these screenplays looking for the right part for, you know, that definitive role for Frank Morgan. And he found one in 1939. He says, "This is it. Our next film is going to be a magnificent film, and I want Frank he doesn't have to audition. I want Frank." And so Frank would walk into the office and said, "Well, yes, sir." And Louis B says, "I've got the part of a lifetime for you, Frank. I have found this role for you. It is yours. It is yours. And when you die, on your tombstone, it's going to say your name and this role in this movie. This is how good this is." First thing out of Frank's mouth, "Well, you didn't give it to Lionel, did you? First?" And of course, Louis B's, "No. I only thought of you." Now, if you're standing opposite your boss, if you are standing opposite your boss, there's one thing you never want to hear, and that's the word, "But there's this other role in this film that is causing me great consternation. And I've lost the lead. I couldn't get the lead that I want. I couldn't get the villain that I want. I'm about to lose the director because he has to go over to Selznick Studios to work with Gable on that Civil War tripe that Gone with the Whatever. But if you could step into this role, this major role in this other film, the role of a lifetime is yours." Well, Frank Morgan wanted to be in this big, big movie, but he didn't want to do the other film. So he, you know, not only did he stutter and stammer, when he really didn't want something, he started to flail. And all of a sudden he sounded something like, "Well, I just can't, what, you know, I just, I don't." And of course, Louis B. Mayer's like, "Calm down, Frank, calm down." And they went back and forth and back and forth. And finally, Louis B. Mayer said, "Look, Frank, I have to put my foot down. But you're gonna have to play the wizard in The Wizard of Oz. And if you do that, the part of a lifetime is yours. You get to be Mr. Matuszek in the shop around the corner." Well, he wanted
Wow.
to be Mr. Matuszek very badly, and he didn't care about the wizard. And so he got the part. And 10 years later, when he's making the movie, Annie, Get Your Gun, and he's out, you know, in front of the cast and crew, no longer stammering, no longer stuttering. He's proud. "I was Mr. Matuszek in the shop around the corner." And of course, the crew is like, "Ooh, ah." Well, a week later, he dropped dead of a heart attack.
Oh.
And he died. But he died a happy man. He knew that he was going to be remembered as Mr. Matuszek. What he didn't count on is television. And television was the game changer. What he didn't count on is exactly what Judy Garland would come to find out, and Ray Bolger, and the Cowardly Lion,
Burt
Burt
Lahr.
and Jack Haley and Margaret Hamilton and Billy Burke, and even the monkeys came to find out. Frank Morgan was going to be remembered as the wizard in The Wizard of Oz, not as Mr. Matuszek. Poor Frank Morgan, he truly was the man behind the curtain. I mean, so there you go. And that,
A
and of
great
course,
story.
yeah.
I have to tell you that Billy Rebeck, my writing partner, and I have written a screenplay about a young girl from our time who, through a series of events, ends up, she is the world's leading authority on The Wizard of Oz. She knows every story, and she ends up going back to 1938, and she's on the set, and
Wow.
she's trying to avert these accidents that we know actually happened, that Buddy Ebsen got allergic to the silver paint,
Sure, absolutely,
that
yeah.
the fireball nearly killed the wizard, the witch of Margaret Hamilton. Somebody stepped on Toto and tore a ligament, or sprained a ligament, all these things. So our wonderful lead, Anne Sherwood, she starts to try to avert these accidents. And when you play around with time travel, you know what happens. And she's called into Louis B. Mayer's office because she's completely disrupted the production. And he tells her to her face, "We're canceling The Wizard of Oz."
Oh.
So now she's responsible for destroying the film she loves. And we're out there now. We're in the process of trying to find a home for this screenplay. We
Look
call it
what do you call
because.
it? Now look at you look at Frank. He's surprised by the story you just told. Look at him. He's upset.
We have a lot of twists and turns. I'm going to turn to another of these wonderful performers you've mentioned. Let's
Lionel Barrymore, of
go to
course.
Lionel Barrymore, because it's funny. I have a question about Lionel, because I know Lionel primarily from seeing It's a Wonderful Life 3,000 times, and he's in a wheelchair. Now, I've also noticed he was in another movie in a wheelchair, and my question to you is, when did he get in a wheelchair? Obviously, he was not able to walk, right?
That's the story I'm going to tell you. And
Okay.
let's just begin with the idea that Lionel Barrymore had no desire to be an actor. During the silent era of film, he wanted to be a painter. And in fact, he painted for much of his life until he died. And he's a very established painter. Most people know his work. I have reproductions of his work, actually, and they're very, very good. So in the silent era, he was such a good actor because, of course, he comes from a family of actors. And his father was an actor as well. He decided that if he can't paint, maybe he can direct, which is kind of 3D painting anyway. And so he became a renowned director of silent films as well as an actor. But when MGM got a hold of him, they said, "Okay, we love you. We think you're one of the finest actors that ever lived. No more directing. You're not going to direct anymore." And that really broke his heart. So instead of, falling apart, he basically told Louis B. Mayer, he says, "I'll tell you what, Louis B., I will act for you, and I'll only do acting, but you better warn the other actors who are on set with me. I'm going to chew up the scenery, and they're going to be upstaged at every chance they can by me. And I'm never going to turn down a role." Poor Frank Morgan. Can you imagine? He makes this edict: "I am never going to turn down a role." And he didn't. And he made wonderful films, of course. He was in Dinner at Eight, in Grand Hotel, Rasputin and the Empress. I mean, the list goes on and on, including this fabulous film, of course, based on Rudyard Kipling's novel, about this fishing expedition and adventure. And of course, every actor in MGM is there: Mickey Rooney and Spencer Tracy and Freddie Bartholomew and John Carradine and Charlie Grapewin, Melvin Douglas. I mean, the list goes on and on, but it was Lionel Barrymore who was the captain in Captain's Courageous. He was the captain. The only problem is throughout the filming of this movie, he kept falling down. And finally, when the movie completed a couple of days after, he fell down again and he broke his hip. So he went to the doctor, and the doctor in 1930, late 37, early 38, says, "You know, Lionel, you got a broken hip, but it'll repair. I'm more concerned about you falling. I need to do further tests." And they did further tests, and they determined that he had advanced degenerative arthritis, and that was going to put him in braces for a year, and then, of course, in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. So he went into the office of Louis B. Mayer, and he said, "Louis B., I have a problem. I fell down and broke my hip." And Louis B. is like, he goes, "I got another problem." And Louis B. Mayer says, "Please, what?" He says, "Well, the doctor has decided that I also have advanced degenerative arthritis, and I'm going to be confined to a wheelchair within a year." Louis B. Mayer's reaction was basically this. I mean, this was his favorite actor, and it was breaking his heart. He says, "Louis B., I've got one more thing." And of course, Louis B. is like, "Please, let me take it all. You've ruined my day. Let me just hear the last thing you have to tell me." And that he said, "Well, I have a lifetime contract that you signed with me, and I expect you to honor it for the rest of my career, even if I'm in a wheelchair." And so Louis B. Mayer was like, of course, Lionel. But remember the buts? But there's this film over at Columbia Pictures, Columbia, that what they're basically known for, the Three Stooges, the two reelers. He goes, "I'd like you to go over and do a film over at Columbia." And he did this film, and of course, what Louis B. Mayer was trying to do was trying to see what the audience reaction would be with Lionel Barrymore confined. And he made this film with Gene Arthur and James Stewart, got second billing actually above James Stewart. And of course, 1938, the year of the adventures of Robin Hood and Betty Davis in her Civil War movie. I mean, there were so many great movies in 38. Everybody's figuring the adventures of Robin Hood was going to win the best picture of the year, but it didn't. It did not.
You're talking about you can't take it with you.
You Can't Take It With You ended up not only winning the best picture of the year, Lionel Barrymore won the hearts of audiences, and he came back MGM triumphant. He was absolutely triumphant in his celebration of acting, and folks didn't care that he was going to end up in a wheelchair. And so he arguably started making a ton of great movies while confined. He was in Test Pilot and in A Guy Named Joe, Duel in the Sun. Of course, he appears, as you mentioned, in It's a Wonderful Life as Mr. Potter. He, of course, appears with Bogey and Bacall and Key Largo. And he's an active doctor in a wheelchair through the entire run of the Dr. Kildare series, showing that you can be active while disabled.
Now,
Now,
Manny, what was the name of the film? I just saw it on Turner Classic Movies. Sir Cedric Hardwicke plays the
bad
devil
guy. Yeah, it's On Borrowed Time.
on Borrowed Time, and he Barrymore. It's since I knew Barrymore primarily from It's a Wonderful Life, it was such a nice thing to see him as the good guy.
Yeah, it is really, really. He could play it all. I mean, he was that talented. He could play the fatherly figure, and he could play absolutely the devil. But other people felt the same way, and there was a lot of people going to his movies. MGM made a lot of money with the Kildare series. And one person out in the audience actually went to the movies, even though she could not see and could not hear. She would watch her movies through Braille, as told by her friends. And it was Helen Keller who said, after finding out who Lionel Barrymore was, what can we do? I think this is a game changer. And basically wrote to Eleanor Roosevelt saying that our time has come to fight the good fight against disease and disability. And she says, let's celebrate the career of Lionel Barrymore. And so Eleanor Roosevelt went to Franklin D. Roosevelt, but FDR was kind of he was kind of confined himself. I mean, he had this disease as well, infantile paralysis. And so he had already started some sort of a campaign to fight infantile. It was called the Fight for Against Infantile Paralysis. But FDR was a very shrewd man, and he decided, I think we have something here. Why don't we celebrate on my birthday every year this fight against infantile paralysis? We'll bring in Hollywood stars like Lionel Barrymore, although they never brought in Lionel because Lionel Barrymore was a Republican. So he never went to the White House while FDR was there. But they would bring in Margaret O'Brien, and they bring in Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney and Eddie Cantor. And Eddie Cantor, one day in the president's office, says, "I love your fight, Mr. President. I love what you're doing. I think it's great. I hate the name of the campaign. It should not be called the Fight Against Infantile Paralysis. You tell me that children are donating money. They're donating their quarters. They're donating their nickels. They're donating their pennies. They're donating their dimes. Let's call it something like the March of Dimes." And FDR is bravo, bravo, that's a great idea. And that one name change helped create the most successful fight against any disease or disability in the history of those campaigns. So
Wow.
successful was this campaign that if today you reach into your pocket and you pull out a dime, you see the face of FDR.
Darn. That's a
And
great
so
story.
it took this fight between three individuals who barely knew each other, a man who, of course, invited Hollywood into the White House every year on his birthday, a woman who went to the movies, even though she was blind and could not hear, in Helen Keller, and a man who had a lifetime contract at MGM and refused to quit. And that was their fight against disease and disability and their tie to Hollywood.
Well, this has been an absolute pleasure. I want to, Manny, I've got to bring you on again. I want to do part two and probably part three because you have a million stories and you're collecting them and they're great stories. And all of the actors you've mentioned today are personal favorites. I've loved their work. Will you come back again?
I will come back anytime you invite me, Steve. How's that?
I'd love that, Manny. Thank you.
I'm
And tell the listeners and the viewers how to find you these days. What's the best way? Can you get the book on Amazon?
You get the book on Amazon. Of course, I have my blog site, ForgottenHollywood.com. And of course, you can listen to my show, my 94 part episodes of Manny Pacheco's Forgotten Hollywood. I tell more stories there, and I use music as the backdrop and also film clips. And that's on Spotify, Manny Pacheco's Forgotten Hollywood. And of course, I like to tour LA and parts beyond. I will be at the Columbus Moving Pictures Festival in May. I will also be at the Turner Classic Movies Film Festival at the big party for the fans in at the Hollywood Heritage Museum in April. And I also will be in April at the Laurel and Hardy International Society, the Way Out West tent in North Hollywood in April as well. So yeah, I'm in and around. I stay busy, and I love telling my stories. And I really do appreciate, Steve, what you do, the work that you've done. You being an author and an historian, it's really wonderful chatting with a colleague for an hour.
We are kindred spirits. You've been listening and watching Stephen J. Rubin's Saturday Night at the Movies. I'm your host. Our producer's Ben Shrewsbury, and our honored guest tonight has been Manny Pacheco, who we will have on again, and that's a promise. Thanks, Manny.
Thank you.